From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. 20 years ago, as the world's attention focused on Atlanta, a bomb exploded in Centennial Olympic Park. President Clinton vowed retribution.
We will spare no effort to find out who was responsible for this murderous act. We will track them down. We will bring them to justice. We will see that they are punished. In the meanwhile, we are all agreed the games will go on.
But it took 5 years for authorities to find Eric Rudolph, the man behind that attack. We'll talk about the criminal case against Rudolph and how that attack changed our views on domestic terrorism. That's coming up. First, though, some cities have imposed curfews, and they were suggested here in Atlanta. But yesterday, Mike Males of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice told us curfews don't work.
Curfews that are imposed generally on everybody tend to work for a very short period of time, but curfews imposed selectively on youth do not work because their function then becomes to remove law-abiding youth from public, to waste police time in enforcing the curfew, and to create antagonistic relationships between the police and young people.
Here are your first thoughts. Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed responded to our interview on Twitter, saying, "That is not true. We are not considering curfews." That's despite several published reports that said Reed was weighing the restriction after protests over the past few weeks. Speaking of those protests, April tweets, "Few outside the movement understand that during days of protests, like-minded people break bread together and care for one another, build lasting friendships, and clarify their common goals. This is the heart of the movement." We also got a call from Coleman Hood of Bishop, Georgia. He says curfews can work.
I have a suspicion that the efficacy of a curfew is in direct proportion to the degree to which it is enforced. When I entered high school, my father gave me a curfew of 11:30 p.m. Did it keep me out of trouble? You're mighty right it did, because you damn well knew what was going to happen if you violated it.
It is great to hear your thoughts on this stuff. Call us at 404-500-9457 like Coleman did. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at OST Talk, or post to Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. The manhunt for Eric Rudolph captivated the nation. Rudolph carried out the deadly bombing at the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, plus three other attacks in the South. He eluded federal authorities for 5 years despite an intensive manhunt. He was eventually found and arrested by North Carolina police officer Jeff Pistell in 2003.
As I approached, he observed me and he took off running and got in behind some milk crates. I took safety into concern and advised him to come out. He complied to everything I asked to do. I think I put a lot of people's feelings at ease, a lot of stress that was involved in this situation. It's a closure to it, I believe.
Rudolph was a self-taught survivalist, and he spent at least some portion of that 5 years camped out in the Appalachian wilderness. Former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr covered the Rudolph case for years and joins me now. It's always good to have you, Kathy.
Good morning.
And also with us is Kevin Reeve. He is the founder and director of On Point Tactical Tracking School and provides training for outdoor survival skills. He joins me by Skype. Hi, Kevin.
Good morning.
So when I say self-taught survivalist, Kevin, does that mean something? I mean, or do you have skepticism about people who are self-taught?
Well, I know some very good survivalists who were self-taught. They spent a lot of time practicing in the woods, but to be really effective in that respect, you need years and years of pretty hardcore training and practice.
You believe, Kevin, that Eric Rudolph had to have had help over the course of that 5 years. Why are you so convinced of that?
Well, we visited both of his camps, the long-term camp that he set up when he first escaped, which was high on the top of a mountain bluff, and we visited his last camp, which was overlooking this town of Murphy, and it was, both of them were very crude. They did not show any true skill in long-term survival. You know, he did not know how to create an effective shelter. He did not know how to gather and preserve food off the land. He was dependent upon the town. He had to go into the town. He went in and essentially stole supplies from a food storage cellar, and then took that up into the mountains with him. And when he was living in his second camp, towards the end of his time in the woods, he was going into town and dumpster diving for food.
Kathy, what did Eric Rudolph himself say about how he survived those 5 years?
Well, he did call himself a survivalist, and he said he lived off the land, ate salamanders and grain. Kevin is right. About 6 months after Rudolph's disappearance, there was a local guy that had a health food store in Murphy, a guy named George Nordman, and he appeared as Rudolph asked him for a list of supplies, money, I think it was $500, and stole his truck, or allegedly stole his truck. And then ultimately, Nordman did not tell the authorities for 2 days that all of this happened. So he was the FBI and other authorities believed that Rudolph was getting help from Nordman and from other people who never came forward.
But Kathy, many of the people in the areas where Rudolph claimed to have been vehemently deny this. Was there any confirmation that someone had helped him out?
I don't think there was any real confirmation, but as I said, many officers who spoke to me and FBI as well said they felt there was no way he could have survived 5 years on his own. And what happened in North Carolina, Murphy and Andrews, is that Rudolph became the folk hero. He kind of a legend, and there were wanted posters up all over the place, but they quit putting them up because people would steal them. And there were signs and bumper stickers saying, "Run, Rudolph, run." There were Eric Rudolph hamburgers at the local joint.
I ate one of those.
Wait, I'm so sorry. We have to stop here for just a moment, Kathy. You ate one of the Rudolph burgers, Kevin?
Yeah. I went into the little burger joint there. They had an Eric Rudolph burger, and I had to order one just because.
What was on it?
It was just a regular burger. They had just renamed.
Oh, they just called it Rudolph.
They called it the Rudolph burger.
Kathy, why did he become kind of a folk hero? Did people support his bombing at the Olympics, or did they? I know he was virulently anti-abortion. Was that what they were supporting?
He was anti-government and anti-abortion, and I think many of the people that were in the mountains in Western North Carolina were also a little bit anti-government. There had been several camps, Christian identity camps, anti-government sort of compounds over the years that had been identified. I don't know that any of them were operating when I was there, or they weren't operating in plain sight. But it was an area known to be anti-government. And so I think people were, in a strange way up there, rooting for him, not as a bomber, but as a fleer, as somebody who could evade the FBI brought in 200 agents or more at one point, and were spending millions of dollars, and it was, look, our government can't catch this guy.
So, Kevin, a lot was made of the fact that Eric Rudolph spent time in the military. Can military training prepare you to live in the Appalachian Mountains?
No. It can prepare you for some very, very basic survival. If you're in a special operations position, or if you're in an air crew, they will send you to what's called SEER school, S-E-R-E. SEER school is designed to train you in escape and evasion. And clearly, as an 11 Bravo or infantryman, as I recall, he did not have that kind of training. He would not have been set. That's something that would be reserved for a Green Beret or a SEAL or a pilot.
One thing, he had lived in the North Carolina woods. He had grown up at least somewhat in that area.
Yeah.
And the people did say, because he grew up there, he knew where to hide. He knew where to fish. And he would go out camping for weeks at a time, disappear.
Mm-hmm.
They asked his mother, where is he? And they assumed that he was in this 5-county area around Murphy and Andrews for that entire 5 years. So he did know his way around those mountains. And he knew caves, and there were abandoned mines that he could have been hiding in.
I have to assume that camping for a week or two is different than lasting for 5 years. But Kevin, you offered your services as a specialist in tracking to the FBI. They turned you down. But you also say that they made some mistakes. What do you think they did wrong when they were trying to find him?
Well, if you're involved in a career at the FBI, you have to cover your behind, and that's essentially what they did. So the first group to arrive on the scene, as I understand it, was the HRT, the Hostage Rescue Team. These guys were good trackers. They knew how to pursue. and they were brought in and began the process. But in order to do effective CYA, they brought in dog
teams. That means cover your behind.
Yeah.
Right,
to do,
go ahead.
To do, yes, CYA is cover your
yes. Yes, you
backside.
Don't need to say the real word. go on.
They brought in dog teams and put dog teams in the field with the trackers. Now, they are incompatible. Dogs destroy tracks. Humans destroy scent. So one or the other, but not both. And then to compound things even worse, they called up all local law enforcement, everybody from anywhere that could come down, and they did what's called ground pounding. They made a big line and marched through the forest, and that destroyed both scent and tracks.
And yeah, and it was pure chance that they got him in the end. And as I understand it, Kathy, he also said after he'd been captured that at one point the police encountered police because he had a flat tire, and they took him to the gas station and just happily let him go.
Yeah, I'm sure they didn't realize who he was.
And this is the thing, even when the local officer in Murphy found a what they thought was a bum at the dumpster, he could have easily let him go. But this guy was, you know, somebody who was trying to do his job. And if I recall the story, he, you know, called in his supervisors and said, hey, I got a guy rummaging behind the grocery store dumpster, could be Eric Rudolph. And their response was, yeah, we'll get back to you in 48 hours. And then they said, wait a minute, could be Eric Rudolph. Okay, we'll get back to you in 20 minutes. Get us his fingerprint. And by the time they identified him, he had already said that, yes, he was Eric Rudolph. And he was very proud of the fact that he had been out there 5 years. They also assumed that he was tired of being out there and that he finally just sort of said, okay, you can capture me.
So, Kevin, walking away from all this, it's been 20 years now since the bombing at the Olympics. Has law enforcement fixed some of the problems that you saw during the search for Eric Rudolph?
Probably not. There's not a lot of understanding. I think most of the time now they go straight to dogs for tracking, but it's just the tracking is not well known. And it's extremely effective. The military has been using it for the last 10 years in Afghanistan and Iraq, and to great effect. But it is not well known among law enforcement.
Kathy, were you about to say something?
If they applied the right tactics, do you think they would have actually found him sooner?
Yeah, I think they could have. He parked his car at the edge of a forest and walked in, which would have left a considerable track signature that the right trackers could have pursued. And in fact, the hostage rescue team was in the act of doing that when everybody else arrived and destroyed.
And mucked it up.
Yeah, they did. There's just no other word for it.
Kevin Reeve is the founder and director of On Point Tactical Tracking School. Kathy Lohr, former NPR correspondent, and covered the search for Eric Rudolph for NPR. Kathy and Kevin, thank you both so much.
My pleasure.
Happy to be here.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Georgia will probably never forget the moment 20 years ago when a bomb exploded in Centennial Olympic Park. The man behind that attack and several others in the South was Florida native Eric Rudolph. Rudolph was arrested after a 5-year manhunt, and he's now serving 4 consecutive life sentences in a Colorado federal prison. Richard Jaffe served as Rudolph's defense attorney before he pleaded guilty in 2005, and he joins us this morning. Hi, Richard.
Good morning, Celeste.
You were partly assigned to this case or chosen for this case because of your experience with death penalty cases. And I wonder what drew you to that particular side of the law?
You're talking about to death penalty work?
Yeah, death penalty cases.
Well, when I was a very young lawyer, a state judge more or less forced me to take a case involving a African-American individual who was convicted, and I think wrongly, for death penalty offense. And I was on that case for 19 years, and ultimately he was totally exonerated. And in fact, he passed away last week, very sadly. And after that, I defended a number of other individuals, and at new trials, was able to win their freedoms. And all of those individuals are doing wonderfully now. All of them lead productive lives and are contributors to society. So that's how I got into it, and that's what drew me to it, was making a difference in that area.
What went through your head when it became clear you were going to be representing Eric Rudolph?
Well, I was actually in a federal trial representing an attorney when the particular judge presiding on my trial was assigned the Eric Rudolph case. And a number of individuals across the United States strongly requested that he appoint me as lead lawyer in the case. And I accepted. The first thing that came to my mind was that Eric Rudolph needs to know a number of things about me, some my experience, but also some of my political beliefs that aren't like his, and also that I was Jewish, and he had expressed historically some
very strongly anti-Semitic feelings. Yeah.
Well, he had expressed anti-Semitic feelings, but you have to understand that I spent a long time discussing these with him and many other topics with him. And that was the first discussion we had to make sure that he was okay with it, because as a criminal defense lawyer, we normally accept challenging cases.
How did that discussion go?
It went really well. It was only about 20 minutes, and he expressed no hesitation. And I reported back to the judge, and then I was the lead lawyer, and then I built a team and also worked with the Atlanta team, who was had excellent lawyers.
Do you think that Eric Rudolph, at least in the courtroom, got a presumption of innocence?
I think he did. He got a presumption of innocence because there was nothing absolutely clear about the Birmingham case, although it was a pretty good circumstantial case with the car tag leaving, et cetera. And in the Atlanta case, there was virtually hardly any evidence. Almost there was no direct evidence in the Atlanta cases, I should say. So he had a presumption of innocence, which dissipated, of course, when he ultimately pleaded guilty and admitted involvement. I've always questioned and will always question, as I did in the book I wrote concerning this, it was a part of the book, whether he could have really pulled this off alone, even in Birmingham, much less at the Atlanta locations. And I will always question that.
Yeah, you suggest that he may have had help. Why do you think that?
I just don't think there's any individual that could have pulled off four different bombings by themselves in areas in which he didn't live. They were very complex. It's just, to me, it was just no way. But Eric Rudolph was, a true believer, and unfortunately misguided in a significant, serious, extreme way. But he was never going to flip on anyone that might have helped him. Now, where I disagree with Kevin, who I understand is the survivalist, but actually there were three summer camps. There were three camps, a summer camp, a winter camp, and then the FBI camp that he visited that overlooked Murphy. And there's no way he had help, because one of the FBI's and government's main purposes after he was arrested and before was to find someone that could help him. And they had thousands of agents, and they scourged the area, and they couldn't find one single individual that helped him. Now, albeit, he did, as Kevin said, he would go to trash bins and he would break into cabins. George Nordman did not help him.
Owned the truck that Eric Rudolph ended up driving and having an encounter with.
Yeah, the truck was broken and he hotwired it and took off, and quickly the truck was stopped and it broke down. And also there was a gas issue, and Eric then hid into a trench. And it was freezing cold, and he was dressed in fatigues and warm clothes. And when the police pulled over, they got him out, and he had no identification, nothing. And they did, in fact, let him go and actually took him to a place where he could get some gas. The other thing he did that I thought was very interesting was is that he learned how to survive, what not to eat. You know, that can kill you in the woods. But he knew what not to eat, what to eat. He was able to eat salamanders, and he was able to fish and hunt to some extent. But one of the most interesting things that I remember he and I talking about was he would climb these very large bins, and he would get beans and grains and other things like that that a survivalist would want. He would bag them up, and then he would take them with him. And then he would basically learn how to preserve them, along with the fruits of his hunting and fishing, by putting them, sealing them, and putting them way down in the water, which was pretty actually ingenious on his part. So it depends on what your definition of a survivalist is, and I don't claim to be one, but he was as close to it as one could get without formal training.
In the last minute that we have, Richard, you know, during his time in confinement, Eric Rudolph has written a number of blogs, even a book and essays that are posted, and many of them condone and even encourage, in some cases, violence. What was do you feel it was the justice served for Eric Rudolph to get four consecutive life sentences and not the death penalty?
Well, it's two different questions. But one, it's unfortunate that he is still espousing those radical, extreme, and violent beliefs. But it's not for me to decide whether justice was served, because one of the victims, the wife of the police officer that was killed by Eric in Birmingham, which was the death penalty offense, she was against the death penalty, at least for him. And so it was much more complex than asking the question of was justice served. That's for others to decide, and depends on your views on the death penalty and your views on him as a person. Because Eric Rudolph was more than the horrific, inexcusable, and atrocious acts that he committed. And one of your guests was addressing the question of why, and she had some interesting insights in it.
Yeah.
But I can't say whether justice was served.
That is Richard Jaffe, attorney who defended Olympic Park bomber Eric Rudolph. Richard, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
The bombing at Atlanta's Centennial Park was not the first terror attack on U.S. soil, not by a long shot. But it did change how investigators and experts viewed domestic terrorism and the threat of terrorism here in our home country. Malcolm Nance joins us, a former U.S. intelligence and counterterrorism official, now serves as the executive director of the Terror Asymmetrics Project on Strategy, Tactics, and Radical Ideology. He joins us via Skype. Hi, Malcolm.
Good morning.
And also on the phone is Anthony Lemieux. He's Associate Professor of Communication at Georgia State University and lead researcher of the university's Transcultural Conflict and Violence Program. Hi, Tony.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let me give you both the same first question to start with, and I'll go to you first, Malcolm. How did the attack on the 1996 Olympics change our understanding of and approach to terrorism, domestic terrorism?
Well, at the time of the bombing, there were 14 joint terrorism task forces around the United States, which the FBI was the lead agency. Those organizations were well suited for the level of terrorist operation that's both domestic and international in the United States at that time. If you remember the 1990s, which today I look fondly on as what we would call the good old bad days. Certainly, the terrorism we see today is an order of magnitude different. But at that time, the FBI's lead agency would operate out of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, do similar investigations as they do today, using local resources. And of course, they would try to prevent any acts. And if an act occurred, they would intervene and carry out the initial investigations, as we saw in the Centennial Park bombing. It didn't change much after the Centennial Park bombing. There was a level of intensity Atlanta itself had a JTTF in the city, and really things wouldn't change dramatically until after 9/11. When we went from 14 JTTFs to now over 106.
And JTTF stands for Joint Terrorism Task Force. Then let me bring that to you, Tony, because, of course, Malcolm just mentioned 9/11, and I think most of us assume that our approach to terror changed dramatically. But before 9/11, Eric Rudolph was, when you thought of a terrorist, was kind of the image that came in your mind. We had the Oklahoma City bombings. We had other terror attacks that occurred on U.S. soil, and Eric Rudolph kind of fit that profile, did he not?
Well, in the sense that, you know, yes, I mean, I think there's the quick answer to the question, but, you know, it's not quite so clear-cut. I mean, one of the things that we learned was that, you know, oftentimes you'd hear about, you know, clinic bombings, and, you know, especially with the Army of God, the kind of group that he was affiliated with.
Yeah, extremist anti-abortion group. Go ahead.
Yeah, so these kinds of attacks were, you know, maybe, you know, referred to as terrorist attacks, but more often thought of as either shootings or bombings, and it didn't quite give us the sense of systematicity to kind of put the pieces together the way that I think we've started to shift towards, certainly in the post 9/11 era, but certainly less with the case of you know, stuff, you know, attacks that aren't committed by Muslim perpetrators. So I think there's a piece of it there. It's still a little bit trickier to put those dots together, but we're certainly more sensitive to that now.
And Malcolm, a few things changed after Eric Rudolph's bombing. And one of the things that many people point to, and this certainly wasn't fixed by 9/11, was the fact that there was so little coordination between law enforcement agencies and even getting the news out to police that there may be a bomb on site was almost impossible at the time. How much did the Olympic bombing change that?
Well, the Olympic bombing changed the relationship between between the FBI and certainly local law enforcement. You see, we had that unfortunate event of Richard Jewell, the security guard who actually at the time was a hero. He actually did warn people of the bombing, and, you know, the investigation went off the rails and started accusing him of perhaps being involved in the bombing itself. You know, basically because the FBI didn't have the ability to reach deeply down into communities on a broad scale like we do today. I train law enforcement all over the United States, and I just did a joint terrorism intelligence training program where I had 200 local law enforcement officers at the street level who all form a terrorism liaison officer program in New York State. And that doesn't include the hundreds and hundreds of others. Right now, the National Joint Terrorism Task Force, which fuses in all of the law enforcement in the U.S. and puts out the circulars, has over 4,000 intelligence officers tasked to it. So as you can see, I mean, when you go from, you know, a street level Atlantic police officers, you know, trying to suss out and gumshoe, as they call it, you know, the basics of this investigation, and the FBI coming in from on high, those two organizations really didn't mesh well at all, because there, you know, it was really not terrorism specialists in Atlanta actually fusing together with terrorism specialists in the FBI. That now has to a certain extent disappeared. One other interesting point that was made: the definition of terrorism was not universally used when domestic terrorist acts were being carried out. I mean, the Army of God had organized, which is the anti-abortion rights group, formed in 1982 and had done dozens of attacks. And as, you know, the other guests mentioned, they were called bombings or shootings or, you know, mailings to abortion clinics, when every one of those things definitely reached the definition of the act of terrorism. I'm actually holding in my hands the 1996 FBI's United States Report on Terrorism, and every one of their acts would meet that. And we still have that problem today of clearly defining terrorism as terrorism, whether it's an American or a foreigner.
We only have about 45 seconds left, but can you address that particular issue? Because there has been a debate in recent years over when to call something terrorism and when to call someone a terrorist.
I think that is probably one of the really critical issues, because if we fail to do that consistently, it has a lot of negative consequences, not the least of which is it confuses the issues. It confuses us with regard to how we would either investigate or prosecute, or even the kind of nature of coverage. So it gives us a skewed sense. So some of the groups, the Patriot movement, the sovereign citizen, some of the groups are perpetrating acts, particularly going after law enforcement, and that doesn't necessarily get considered in the same wheelhouse of terrorism. And to Malcolm's point, I mean, this very much fits in there. And from a law enforcement perspective, we know that's one of their huge concerns, because there is that intent and there's capability there that can be acted on in this particular way. So that's where I think we really need to make sure we've got that understanding fairly tight in use of that word as consistent as possible.
Anthony Mew is a Georgia State University Associate Professor of Communication, lead researcher of the university's Transcultural Conflict and Violence Program. Malcolm Nance is Executive Director of the Terror Asymmetrics Project on Strategy, Tactics, and Radical Ideology. Thanks so much to both of you.
Our pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. 20 years ago, a bomb exploded in Centennial Olympic Park during the 1996 Summer Olympics. But that wasn't the only attack that happened in the city. Eric Rudolph left a pair of bombs at a gay bar in 1997. It was called the Other Side Lounge. No one died in that bombing, but several were injured. Owners Dana Ford and Beverly McMahon recall the attack and how it changed their lives.
It was Friday night at 10:30. It was one of the highlights of the club. We had over a couple hundred people, Dana.
Yeah, I think 100, 150 to 200 people were there, because we did a lot of tourist business. During that time, we got a call from our manager that there was an explosion on the patio. And he said, at the time, you know, you speculate, you know, transformer or something of that nature, and that's what he was speculating. I myself knew there was nothing out there that would be that powerful to blow up.
Once again, a bomb in the night. It happened outside a lesbian club called The Other Side.
When I arrived and started coming into the driveway, the valet was still hanging outside. I gave my key to them and went inside to make an assessment. There was somebody frantically being treated on the floor. Obviously, it looked to me like they were bleeding out. There was a woman on the phone that had blood drenched on one half of her body. So, you know, and all this is processing very fast. It's not as long as I'm speaking. I'm just making those assessments. And I walked back to the cop, who was still there, and young guy. And I said, so what do you think? And he goes, I guess it must have been a bomb, just like that. And I said, well, I think you're probably right. So I said, who's the officer on duty or in charge of the scene? And he gave me a name, and I went out front, and she was actually a sergeant. And she turned to me and said, we think we found another device. And I said, okay, what do we need to do? And she said, well, we need to get the people out of there, and we can't let them know that we found something. We have to keep them calm. Didn't go off when it was supposed to. Which, you know, is probably why I'm here and those people who are exiting are here, because it was right about that time. And then and law enforcement actually had trouble getting it to fire. You know, they shook it, they hit it with water cannon, they threw a live round at it, and it really didn't even go off until they were actually moving it.
A police robot shot it with a stream of water about 2 this morning, and it exploded.
The ATF agent asked who owned the Lincoln that was in the driveway, and we said we did. She goes, well, you used to own it, and it's totaled now, but just know that it saved the lives of about 3 officers, because it absorbed a lot of the blast.
As in the double bombing last month, there was no warning, but Atlanta Police Chief Beverly Harvard says someone did call after the explosion.
I'm not going to go into details about it.
Atlanta Mayor Bill Campbell.
We clearly believe that we are dealing with a deranged killer, but one who is very clever as well.
No one knew who set those bombs off. You know, so the community was really afraid to come back in. I tried everything to recapture and make it happen, but you know, I'm sure you know that we didn't get financially our insurance money, things that we should have.
Back then, they didn't have that kind of coverage necessarily for terrorist acts. It was acts of God and assaults. That's what they were worried about in the bar business. And Bev and I, we were at a loss for how do you market against fear.
We lost about $5 million through all of this.
5.8.
So that's very hard to swallow.
I would like to introduce the director of the ATF, Director McGaw.
Thank you, sir. Most people came to the lounge in Atlanta to meet with friends and enjoy relaxation. At least one came with hatred, with intent to injure.
Because it went on 5 years to find Eric Rudolph, that's really what took us all the way down.
Today's capture of Eric Robert Rudolph in North Carolina ends a five-year manhunt.
We saw him in person at the court. We all had a chance to speak with him. He just stares at you with just a hollow look. That's one of my dreams. I would love to go to the prison and ask him why. Why did he do that? He didn't answer that question to me in court. I told him I would pray for him, which I do. Try to keep my anger and keep myself focused on, I can't get the money back. I can't get a lot of things back, but I am so blessed to have my family and my friends, my church. Dana and I are very, very lucky, even though, you know, I have to work the rest of my life. I'm not sure I like that, but, you know, maybe it's keeping me younger. Who knows?
Dana Ford and Beverly McMahon owned the Other Side Lounge, a gay bar in Atlanta that was bombed in 1997 by Eric Rudolph. That story was produced by Sean Powers. Open Door Community has served Atlanta's homeless population for 30 years, but lack of leadership, some gentrification, and rising maintenance costs has forced one of the city's longest-running shelters to close its doors. Open Door is not the only shelter that might close. Mayor Kasim Reed has pushed for years to close down Peachtree Pine Shelter as well. That's a massive shelter that can house more than 500 people. Recent closures over the past few years have raised questions about what happens to a city when resources for the homeless community dry up. And here to talk about that is Richard Cho. He's Director of Behavioral Health at the Council of State Governments Justice Center. And he also served as former Deputy Director on the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. It's good to have you, Richard.
Great. Good to be here.
What research have we done? What kind of evidence do we have now about what ways cities can effectively deal with homeless citizens and which things don't work?
That's a great question. You know, I think if you really look at the different ways that communities have tried to respond to homelessness, you can really think about four different ways that they've done that. On the one hand, you have some communities who try to treat it like a charitable cause and where you see a lot of them focused on the kind of crisis services, homelessness shelters, food pantries, things like that. On the other hand, there's also a way to treat it like a pathology, and that's where people resort to thinking that they could treat people, kind of treat the underlying conditions and help them exit homelessness and sort of have them have to fix some of their underlying social and health problems before they can actually exit homelessness. Communities also sometimes treat it like a nuisance, and that's where you see them resorting to policing and law enforcement responses. That tend to kind of sweep the problem under the rug, ultimately pushing people into jail, which is not a long-term solution. And last, I think what we've seen to be most effective is where you treat it like what it is, which is a housing crisis and a public health crisis. And the communities, I think, that have used an approach where they provide targeted outreach to individuals who are in shelters or are living on the streets and connect them to permanent, affordable housing linked to social services that can help them keep that housing, that's proven time and time again and through research and evidence that it's the only real solution to homelessness.
We did reach out to Mayor Reed about the city's approach to homeless individuals and their families. They emailed us a lengthy statement. You can find the full thing at our Facebook page. But I want to read a portion of it. The mayor responded to the plans to replace the Pine Peachtree shelter, at least, and said, quote, putting a new facility at this location will enable emergency responders to reach nearly any destination within city limits in 14 minutes or less, a vital benchmark as we look back on the terror attacks in major cities over the past year. Mayor Reed has also stated the individuals at Peachtree Pine will be connected with resources. In fact, the community of homeless service providers in the city have established a plan to serve the individuals and families staying in that shelter. End quote. That's a portion of the statement from the city. But let's go back, Richard, to these four approaches that you mentioned. They were charity, which is when you treat homelessness like a crisis. Pathology, which is, I assume, when you start dealing with mental health services, especially when you deal with it as a nuisance or as a housing crisis. You said housing crisis is the best way to think of homelessness. And we spoke on this program about Utah's approach in terms of just building enough housing for everyone. Why is that the best way to look at homelessness?
Well, I think that when you look at some of the other approaches, when you focus on just providing crisis services, and let me be clear, you know, crisis services are absolutely critical. People who experience homelessness, they have immediate crisis needs. They have issues of hunger. They have issues of just needing to be away from the elements. You know, just providing those crisis services alone doesn't help them actually exit homelessness. In the same way, if you try to look at trying to provide people with treatment, either mental health treatment or treatment for drug and alcohol use, before they actually exit homelessness, it's a little like, as somebody once put it, shooting an elephant with a BB gun. Essentially, you're trying to treat people's behavioral health conditions, but these folks don't have a stable place to live, and they don't have a stable life. And so thinking about how you can actually achieve recovery in a setting where you're still dealing with your sort of basic survival needs and you don't even know where you're going to be from one day to the next is sort of like pushing a boulder up a hill. I think really what we found is that when places like Utah, but also places like New Orleans and Houston and many other cities across country have focused on providing people with housing first and then wrapping services around them as they need, and that could be services to help find a job or services to deal with drug or alcohol use or their mental health issues. But again, if you don't provide that stable platform of housing, a place where people can actually relax and actually start to tackle some of their other issues, it's really difficult to treat any other conditions. And so that housing first approach has proven, I think, to be effective time and time again.
My guest is Richard Cho. He's Director of Behavioral Health at the Council of State Governments Justice Center. And yet there have been arguments made here in Atlanta and in other places as well that the more beds you build for a homeless population, the more homeless you will have. And I guess that's the theory behind if you build great services for homeless citizens, that people will be attracted to that city who are homeless. What is the actual evidence on that issue?
Yeah, the data is not clear on that. And I think a lot of communities around the country, Atlanta's not alone, in worrying about the fact that if you continue to provide more services, then you just create a draw for more people experiencing homelessness. You know, it's not proven to necessarily be the case. There have been cities that have had very unfriendly policies on homelessness, and they still see a rising rate of homelessness coming to their street. The truth is, I think majority of people who are experiencing homelessness, you know, there is some mobility among that population. But the truth is, most people go where they feel they have some connection to, either because of some history or because they had family members that they were in touch with that were close by. In other cases, they are moving to cities or to metropolitan locations because they know they can access some basic services there. But you see, when you look at the data on homelessness nationally, you actually see that it's pretty evenly distributed and reflective of the distribution of the overall U.S. population. You have homelessness in rural areas, you have homelessness in big cities, you have it in suburban towns. And so the idea that, you know, if you concentrate services in a big city, that's going to sort of draw everybody to the major city center, I don't know that there's a ton of evidence that really shows that that's the case.
How does economics fit into this? Many people have said that one of the reasons that Atlanta still has a large homeless population is because Atlanta is the major city with the largest rate of income inequality. And we certainly saw a rise in the number of homeless people and people needing emergency services during the Great Recession. So as the economy improves, can we expect the homeless crisis to abate?
There's definitely a link between the larger economic situation and rates of homelessness. It's undeniable that, you know, I think the primary driver of homelessness rates is the lack of access to affordable housing. The complicated thing is that we're talking about people who are at the very bottom of the housing market, people who are so in such poverty that for them, they're really looking for rental housing that is of the cheapest variety. And so when you have larger economic forces that are driving up rent, what you have is a kind of down the road effect where the first people who experience that are the middle class. But as they get squeezed out and start to, less home ownership, they start to become more renters, that starts to create a trickle-down pressure on the people who are at the lowest end of that housing market. And that's when you start to see rising rates of homelessness. With the rising economy, the unfortunate thing is that that often also means that the housing market tends to go up. And with rising rents, you have even fewer rental available apartments at the lower end of the market. And so just a rising economy doesn't always lift all boats in this case. This is a situation where...
Since you mentioned that, I just wanted to also mention that, you know, over the past few years, the amount of affordable housing has gone down by 5% every single year for the past 4 or 5 years in Atlanta. Does that mean there's a direct connection between the amount of affordable housing or do people, when they get evicted, when an apartment complex gets torn down, do they move on?
I think both happens, but the people who end up becoming homeless are not folks who are usually the ones who lose their rental housing for the first time. These are folks who've probably been on a downward spiral for quite some time, have been in economic crisis for quite some time. And so, there is a sort of indirect and sort of down the road effect you see, but people who experience homelessness are the ones who their situation has been on decline for quite a while. It's never the case that the first eviction that they have lets them become homeless. People who do lose housing in that way, I think there's an effective solution, which is to provide them with that kind of emergency assistance to help them get back into housing. Because the more, one eviction leads to a second eviction, leads to further housing instability, and those are the folks who are on the road to becoming homeless for the long term.
That's Richard Cho. He's Director of Behavioral Health at the Council of State Governments Justice Center. He also served as former Deputy Director on the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. Richard, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And again, we did reach out to the mayor's office. They provided us with a statement on the mayor's approach to handling the homeless citizens in Atlanta. You can find that at our Facebook page. That's our show for today, but let's get your opinion on this. How can we best help homeless Georgians? More shelters, permanent housing, institutions? Give us a call and let us know your opinion at 404-500-9457. You can reach us on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.